almost suspicious frown. She was dressed in an off-white suit that was tailored severely enough to look businesslike, yet took advantage of her tall, full figure and long legs. Scant jewelry, merely a choker of pearls with matching pearl earrings, and the diamond-studded gold wedding band that Morgan had given her so long ago. Beautiful enough to be a screen star, Jane had earned her law degree in her native Seattle, where she met a lanky, bashful Texan named Morgan Scanwell. He was an agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Jane went into corporate law, and when she helped Morgan to get a new assignment in Houston, she went to Texas with him. They married, he left the FBI and went into politics, with Jane guiding his every move and helping to overcome his natural shyness. They met Dan Randolph in Houston, an eager, impetuous, blithely reckless former astronaut driving hard toward his first millions. Dan raised money for Morgan's campaigns. They became close friends. So close that Jane and Dan flirted in and out of an affair that started and stopped time and again, only to start once more. If Morgan knew, he gave no indication. And Jane pretended not to notice her husband's occasional dalliances. Morgan became governor of Texas, then a senator. And then he ran for president as the ultimate confrontation of the Cold War took shape and the dark clouds of nuclear annihilation gathered on every horizon. One of the women on their public relations staff came up with the idea of having Jane run alongside her husband for the vice presidency. Dan thought it was little more than a gimmick. But the gimmick won almost every woman's vote in the country. When Morgan took the oath of office as president, his running mate became vice president. When Morgan died in office, little more than a year later, the victim of Soviet pressures and the collapse of American will, Jane Scanwell became the first woman president in the history of the United States. And by that time, Dan Randolph had renounced his American citizenship and fled to Venezuela. "Just out of curiosity," Jane asked him, "how did you get in here? Security was supposed to be airtight." "Yes, I know. They checked out every member of the staff very carefully." Her eyebrows lifted in a wordless question. "When I found out that you were going to give a speech in New Orleans, I bought this place. I'm the owner. But technically speaking, Madam President, you are my guest." Dan made a sweeping, old-fashioned bow. Jane could not help laughing. "You rogue. So when the security people checked out the staff, they checked out the owner as well. All I had to do was show up and prove to your trigger-happy guards that I actually am Everett McKinley of Minneapolis, the owner of this noble and ancient house." They were standing in the suite's morning room, furnished in cushioned white wicker chairs. Decanters of wines and brandies stood on the serving table next to the door that led to the actual bedroom. Heading for the liquor, Dan asked, "Can I pour you something?" "That was quite a speech you gave. I watched you on television." Jane sat on the settee next to the curtained window. "What did you think of it?" "You were incredible," Dan said, pouring two snifters of brandy. "The country's flat on its back, so you told them they've got no place to go but up. Quite a performance." Her green eyes went cold. "You're being sarcastic." Handing her one of the snifters, he replied, "Not really. I don't think you could do anything else. They all know that things have gone to the dogs. They look to you for hope." "That's right. They do." Dan lifted his glass and muttered, "Salud. You're not in South America now." He grinned sheepishly. "I forgot. I'm getting accustomed to the place." They sipped at the brandy. Dan made a sour face. "Cheap crap. I'll have to raise hell with the staff." "It's my favorite brand," the president said. "Your staff checked with my people." "Your favorite? This garbage?" "Yes. And it was Morgan's favorite, too." Dan felt his face tighten. "He never was much of a drinker. But you are. You're a man of the world, aren't you, Dan? Better to let that one pass you by," he told himself. Yet, as he pulled one of the smaller wicker chairs up close to the settee and sat in it, Dan said, "There wasn't anything I could do to help. You know that. You could have stayed by him." Jane answered in a low voice. There was anger in it, even after years. "He needed every friend he had. God knows there were few enough of them. I came to the funeral, Dan said. I wasn't invited, but I snuck in anyway. A lot of good that did. He took a long pull on the brandy, despite its acrid roughness, remembering how Morgan preferred raw bourbon to 20-year-old scotch, well-done steak to veal cordon bleu. So you thought my speech gave the people hope, Jane said. Her tone was determinedly brighter. She was trying to put the past behind them, Dan saw. Yes, I did. And? He looked at her. Come on, Dan, what else? What do you really think? Shrugging, he replied, You came into office to govern a nation that's turned its back on its responsibilities. They've stuck their heads in the sand, Jane. They got tired of the tensions and the pains of being a world leader. They let their fears rule them, fears of nuclear energy, fears of weapons, fears of war, fears of inflation, fears of taxes. They had a right to be afraid of those things. Sure they did. They had a right to be afraid of the Russians, too. But their other fears overpowered that. Morgan's predecessors gave our power away, piece by piece. We abandoned Israel, we got out of Latin America, we gave up on nuclear power, we froze our missiles, we let NATO break up. Morgan wanted to change that. The people elected him to bring us back to greatness. They elected him by the thinnest majority since Kennedy squeaked past Nixon, and the day of his inauguration, the Russians announced their missile defense satellites were operational. And what was left of our strategic missile force was useless. Jane said quietly. Morgan had his first heart attack that night. Dan felt a pang of surprise. I didn't know. No one did. Not even the cabinet or most of the White House staff. Her green eyes drifted into the past again. He never really was president. I was. From that very first day. And now you're going to stand for election. I'll win. She said flatly. The mist in her eyes disappeared. I heard a lot of citizens complaining out there, Dan said, jabbing a forefinger in the general direction of New Orleans. She almost smiled. What else is new? It's their right to complain. They claim there are Russians in the White House, telling you what to do. Nonsense. But the Soviets do have a pretty effective veto on anything you want to do, don't they? Certainly not, she snapped. This nation is free, and will remain free. Anyone who thinks otherwise is a fool or a malicious liar. He smiled at her. Good. That's the answer I was hoping for. What are you driving at, Dan? A way out of the mess we're in. A way to help bring this country back to greatness. She gave him a quizzical, almost unbelieving look. The United States was not prostrate, they both knew. It was merely impotent. The people's fear of Armageddon had faded. In its place was America the second-rate power, America the debtor nation, America the coal burner, who could not afford to buy oil, whose major export was food, who had to import high-technology products such as computers and jet airplanes and electric automobiles. America disarmed, its obsolete nuclear missiles dismantled under the watchful eyes of international inspectors, Russian, Eastern European, and most humiliating of all, Cuban. Its troops mustered out of service, its vast panoply of weapons sold to other nations or left to slowly rust away in the southwestern deserts. And it was America the unbrilliant as well. 6 years had passed since the last American had won a Nobel Prize. The brain drain worked in reverse. Bright American scientists and engineers went overseas to find career opportunities. Dan himself had been part of the earliest wave in that flow, seeking work as an astronaut in Japan's space program when it became clear to him that the United States was abandoning space. It's a little late for your kind of help, Jane said. But I know what you're after. You're going to send a mission out to an asteroid to prove they can be sources of raw materials for your factories in space. He sagged back in his chair, a shock of alarm racing through him. Jane broke into a smile. We are not without our sources of intelligence, Dan. He recovered and grinned weakly back at her. So I see. Congratulations. But if you know, do the Russians? No, I don't believe so. There are people who are friendly to us and not to the Russians. You know how the top dog is hated. Now that we are not top dog anymore, we have lots more friends than we used to. Dan kept the smile on his face, but his stomach felt as queasy as the first few minutes in freefall. If she knows, the Russians must know, he thought.